Blog Talk Radio.
Other major cities and airports and transit systems are under police and FBI
FBI terror alert. Were the bombs a wake-up call to civil war? What was the demographic of the majority of runners in the marathon? They were all liberal and white, Massachusetts. This is the majority. I'm not saying all. Of course, Kennedy Democrats, retired or semi-retired baby boomers, students, teachers, and the Obama supporters and progressive gun control advocates from blue states of Connecticut, Massachusetts, as well as the other blue states. Also, members of other New World Order countries and UN and EU supporters of the Arms Control Treaty, recently signed by the majority of members and the U.S. at the UN. I believe the Boston bombing was a political statement made by a political group on tax day, April 15, 2013. I believe the Boston bombing was a signal to the American people and the U.S. government and to the world that the revolution has begun. Note that no guns or gun was used in the Boston Marathon bombing. The Boston bombing is the beginning, and it happened on April 15, 2013, American Tax Day, Patriot Day. Americans must get ready for this war. We must not let it take us by surprise. This country is sustained by faith of its people in these ideals, or their ideals, and the courage and democratic commitment of their elected leaders. Our recent polls show Americans have the lowest opinion of their government since polling first began. The revolution has begun, and it cannot be stopped. The walls of Wall Street will soon shake by the massive weight of the people pushing against them to destroy the corrupt monetary system and those who run it. My great wish for this country is that the revolution is not violent. The Boston bombing is a senseless, barbaric attack against innocent people by a violent group, individual, or government who see violence as their only option and innocent Americans as their enemies. An 8-year-old boy lost his life by one of the bomb blasts. The loss of his innocent life and the death of two other innocent people and the injury of over 150 people by the bombing are not the revolutionary symbols and vision of a future I want to be a part of. And I can't seem to put my head around this one much more. Maybe it's a false flag operation, I've been told. Makes a lot of sense that it was. Follows the pattern. It's something so diabolical that that you wouldn't want to think that just your own government could do it to you. But it possibly has. And I guess what disturbs me the most about this is the randomness of it, but how the media is harping on this thing. And it's only been 2 days, and all of a sudden they've got two suspects from a crowds of hundreds of thousands of people. They're looking at two specific guys, look like college kids, all right, with backpacks. It's like, now these kids, once they're targeted, their lives are ruined, even if they had nothing to do with it other than carrying their books down the street or whatever. I don't know. But to put a search warrant out there on somebody, all right, it was not even for no reasonable suspicion other than he had a backpack in a crowd of faces all over the place. You know, it just ruined our lives. And what can I tell you? You have no rights, buddy. It's like, you know, some poor guy gets caught in some kind of a DUI or some kind of something with his pants down. You know, and the next thing he's on local news as a sex offender, and all he did was probably take a leak on the side of the road. So it's like, you know, this is the kind of stuff that's getting out of hand with the media. Is there judging and they're judge and jury and then prosecutor all in one, and they're throwing people's faces and ruining their lives and livelihoods, you know. Before they've even been convicted or, you know, have any, you know, they may be arrested, but, I mean, arrested for under what, you know. So what I'm saying is that there's a terrible abuse of privacy, today. And, you know, my God. But, you know, again, I feel terrible for the people that lost their lives and the people that lost their legs and the people that, it's just a horrific, horrific nightmare for anybody who was there. And having seen the pictures of it, and I just, you know, I can't wrap my head around the senseless violence by any group or organization. But I can understand why someone would do that if they had the intention of, if their intention was, like the government's, to push people, push them further over the edge toward gun control. Now, this was right before the Senate was to vote for gun control. Now, they might have had a better chance if somebody would have machine gunned everybody there, they know, for passing the gun, but no, they bombed the place. So, you know, but I'm grateful I never thought I'd say I was going to be grateful to the Republicans, but, you know, on this one, folks, I was with you on this one. We need those weapons, and people need weapons in this country. This is why people need weapons, you know, to defend themselves from people who have weapons illegally, you know, or people who want to do you harm, including your own government. Well, we'll see what turns out. But I'm in a very strange place with this, because I'm much more angry this could be, especially after what happened with Sandy Hook and those kids, and then all of a sudden you see this, and it's just a mess. And the odds are that the government is now trying to crack down on patriots, people who constitutionalists, independents, they could possible homegrown terrorism. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens. And you know, another thing that was interesting, and I thought, just to play along with the media brainwashing techniques, there was a very large explosion in a fertilizer factory in Texas yesterday, and it killed a whole bunch of people and blew up, you know, all kinds of, the explosion was heard 45 miles away. But, you know, the first people on the scene, and one of the first people that the mainstream media network news talked to was some guy who said, oh, this is just like Oklahoma City, you know, that blew up a fertilizer, you know, bomb. And it was like, it was a fertilizer factory, moron, you know. Somebody might have lit a match around ammonia or something has sparked and blew the whole damn place up. You know, because, that's what happens with these fertilizers, some of these fertilizers. So, But it's just funny how the first thing they thought of was the Oklahoma bombing, even though this was a big fertilizer factory and that was an office building in Oklahoma. But, you know, they want you to remember that. They want you to connect that. You know, oh, wow, there's more terrorists. There's bigger terrorists. Oh, God, there's frightening. It's so scary, you know. Yeah, it's so scary. What scares you is, you know, the thought of the possibility of your own government doing this to, so that you panic and want to take your and want to give them all your guns, you know, give up your rights, and oh, please save me, save me, save me. Yeah, they're saving you, save me from you. You know, it's like extortion, you know, extorting the tag of the American people, you know. But I don't know. I'm just tired of it. I'm tired of it, folks. But I wanted to read something tonight. And this is from one of my favorite books in the world, called Rules for Radicals by Saul Alinsky. And a good friend of mine, Buddy Radical, gave this to me. They told me about it. I bought the book. And fascinating book. But this was a guidebook for radicals, basically. But there's a chapter in here that I thought I'd like to read tonight. It's called A Word About Words. The passion of mankind have boiled over into all areas of political life, including its vocabulary. The words most common in politics have become stained with human hurts, hopes, and frustrations. All of them are loaded with political opprobrium, and their use results in a conditioned negative emotional response. Even the word politics itself, which Webster says is the science and art of government, is generally viewed as in a context of corruption. Ironically, the dictionary synonyms are discreet, provident, diplomatic, and wise. The same discolorations attached to other words prevalent in the language of politics, words like power, self-interest, compromise, and conflict, they become twisted and warped, viewed as evil. Nowhere is the prevailing political illiteracy more clearly revealed than in these typical interpretations of words. This is why we pause here for a word about words. And I thought this was... He was right, you know. He was so right. We abuse words, and we don't know what the hell we're talking about, you know, a lot of the times. I'm proud to bring up years ago, in fact, I don't even recall which, whether it's in one of my articles or a number of them, but I wrote an essay a number of years ago. I published an essay a number of years ago on the words liberalism and conservatism, based right from the Webster's Unabridged Dictionary. Okay? And the meaning for a liberal, now this is true, is the definition was a liberal. Believes in the best of man. And in the same book, a conservative or conservatism is the belief in the worst of man. Now, isn't that interesting? I thought. And how those words have been twisted around over the last 100 years, okay, until they're meaningless, you know, unfortunately. I thought when I wrote Naked at the Mic, Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril, that actually I was considered quite liberal at the time and by other radio stations and other radio and other writers, and I was considered quite liberal. But since the George Bush years and since we've had Obama in the office, I've been told by a number of conservatives that I'm much more of a libertarian than I am of a liberal. I thought, oh, wow, that's interesting. I always thought that I was, had a more of a liberal bent, you know. Not that I was a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat under any circumstances or a Republican, but I just followed my own drummer, and I didn't really want to. I never joined a party. I was always registered as an independent. So, and I always will be till the day I die. But you know, as far as I'm concerned, certain words have lost their meanings or have been changed so much. Saul Alinsky talks about a few different kinds of words here, and one is power. He says, the question may legitimately be raised, why not use other words, words that mean the same but are peaceful and do not result in such negative emotional reactions? There are a number of fundamental reasons for rejecting such substitution. First, by using combinations of words such as harnessing the energy, or instead of the single word power, we begin to dilute the meaning. And as we use purifying synonyms, we dissolve the bitterness, that anguish, the hate and the love, the anger and the triumph attached with these words, and leaving an aseptic imitation of life. In the politics of life, we are concerned with the slaves and the Caesars, not the Vestal Virgins. It is not just that in communication, as in thought, we must either strive towards simplicity. The masterpieces of philosophic or scientific statement are frequently no longer than a few words. For example, E equals MC squared. It is more than that. It is a determination not to detour around reality. To use any other word but power is to change the meaning of everything we are talking about. As Mark Twain once put it, the difference between the right word and the wrong word, the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug. That's so true. That's so true. And power is the right word, just as self-interest, compromise, and the other simple political words are, for they were conceived and have become part of politics from the beginning of time. To pander to those who have no stomach for straight language and insist upon bland, non-controversial sauces is a waste of time. They cannot or deliberately will not understand what they are discussing here. I agree with Nietzsche's statement in the Genealogy of Morals on this point. And he says, why stroke the hypersensitive ears of our modern weaklings? Why yield even a single step to the tartuffery of words? For us psychologists, that would involve a tartuffery of action. For a psychologist today shows his good taste. Others might say his integrity in this. If in anything that he resists the shamefully moralized manner of speaking, which makes all modern judgment about men and things slimy. That's very weird. But what it is that, you know, we understand, you know,
unless you make people uncomfortable,
things ain't going to change. You know, they're just not going to change. And I guess that's what I'm looking at here tonight. The thought that I had for this program is that this terror, these acts of terror that we're seeing, they may be very well the acts of the terror of our own government, very possible. I'm not putting that out at all, but I wouldn't doubt that. But the problem with this is how it is rattling our own brains, how it's affecting our own selves, how all these sunspots and everything else are affecting us, what kind of insanity is Kim Jong-un on? What kind of drugs is he using? You know what I mean? And I want to talk about a power trip there. Yeah, that's definite power trip. The mad leader of North Korea right now. But let me move on a little on this board of power. We approach a critical point when our tongues trap our minds. I do not propose to be trapped by tact at the expense of truth. And striving to avoid the force, vigor, and simplicity of the word power, we soon become averse to thinking in vigorous, simple, honest terms. We strive to invent sterilized synonyms, cleansed of the opprobrium of the word power. But the new word means something different, so that they tranquilize us, begin to shepherd our mental process of the main conflict, ridden, grimy, and realistic power-paved highway of life. It's like how they name the wars. You know, they give these poetic names to these wars. Like what was the one there? Bush's war. Enduring freedom, and what was the other one? His father's one, that massacre there in Kuwait. I forgot what the name of that one was. It'll come to me. There was another, stupid euphemism, you know, for a genocidal and homicidal attack against the country, the people. Just amazing. But you know, this newspeak and this speak that we hear now today, this political correctness that we hear everywhere. I'm not one to write that way, but at the same time, I understand what's happening all around me with it. We strive to invent sterilized synonyms, cleansed of the word power, and for the new words, it seems something different, that they would tranquilize us, begin to shepherd our mental processes off the main conflict-ridden, grimy, and realistic power-paved highway of life. To travel down the sweeter, smelling, peaceful, more socially acceptable, more respectable, indifferent byways ends in us failure to achieve an honest understanding of the issues that we must come to grips with if we are to do the job. Let us look at the word power. Power means ability, whether physical, mental, or moral, to act has become an evil word, with overtones and undertones that suggest the sinister and unhealthy, the Machiavellian. It suggests a phantasmagoria of the nether regions. The moment the word power is mentioned, it is as though hell has been opened, exuding the stench of the devil's cesspool of corruption. It evokes images of cruelty, dishonesty, selfish arrogance, dictatorship, and abject suffering. The word power is associated with conflict. It is unacceptable in our present Madison Avenue deodorized hygiene, where controversy is blasphemous and the value is being liked and not offending others. Power, in our minds, has become almost synonymous with corruption and immorality. Whenever the word power is mentioned, someone sooner or later will refer to the classical statement of Lord Acton and cite it as follows: power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. In fact, the correct quotation is: power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. We can even read Acton's statement accurately. We can't even read his statement accurately. Our minds are so confused by our conditioning. The corruption of power is not in power, but in ourselves. And yet, what is this power when men live by and to a significant degree live for? Power is the very essence, the dynamo of life. It is the power of the heart pumping blood and sustaining life in the body. It is the power of the active citizen, participation pulsing upward, providing a unified strength for a common purpose. Power is an essential life force, always in operation, either changing the world or opposing change. Power or organized energy may be a man-killing explosive or a life-saving drug. The power of a gun may be used to enforce slavery or to achieve freedom. The power of a human brain can create man's most glorious achievements and develop perspectives and insights into the nature of life-opening horizons. Previously, beyond the imagination. And the power of the human mind can also devise philosophies and ways of life that are most destructive for the future of mankind. Either way, power is the dynamo of life. Alexander Hamilton, in the Federalist Papers, put it this way: what is a power but the ability of faculty? The ability or faculty of doing a thing. What is the ability to do a thing but the power of employing the means necessary to its execution? Pascal, who was definitely not a cynic, observed that justice without power is impotent. Justice without justice is tyranny. Power without justice is tyranny. St. Ignatius, founder of the Jesuit order, said, did not shrink from the recognition of power when he issued his dictum: I do a thing well, a man needs power. To do a thing well, a man needs power and competence. He could call the roll of all who have played their parts in history and find the word power, not a substitute word, used in their speech and writings. It is possible to conceive of a world devoid of power. The only choice of concept is being organized and unorganized power. Mankind has progressed only through learning how to develop and organize instruments of power in order to achieve order, security, morality, civilized life itself, instead of sheer struggle for political or physical survival. Every organization known to man, from government down, has had only one reason for being, that is organization for power, in order to put into practice or promote its original, its common purpose. When we talk about a person lifting himself by his own bootstraps, we are talking about power. Power must be understood for what it is, for the part it plays in every area of our life. If we are to understand it and thereby grasp the essentials of relationships and functions
between groups and organizations, particularly in a pluralistic society. To know power and not fear it is essential to its constructive use and control. In short, life without power is death. A world without power would be a ghostly wasteland, a dead planet.
He's right. You have to be able to harness this power. And by harnessing it, you have to know what it is. We've done a lot of work, a lot of
work over the years studying the effects of power and the governments and, businessmen and so on. And having had some and having known what it was like, power is a aphrodisiac, both for men and women. But it's an aphrodisiac in the sense that it's like it's like testosterone, I guess, or something, or some hormone that we seek as people, and to degrade it, it means that we don't even know what it is that we're seeking. And power is strength, Power is strength. So it is. Strength in numbers, strength in character, strength in physical power, physical ability, strength in mental ability. That's your power, to disguise that word for anything less than power is more or less a exercise in, futility, because you want something, but yet you don't even accept what it is that you can't even say the word. But going back to the word power again, the negativity of power, the word power, but I mean, in this bombing, for instance, I mean, that was a power that the person had over all of these lives, right? By blowing up 150 people, and suddenly having, worldwide recognition on what you just did. That's got to be quite amazing. And that's what power is, even if it's for that moment. You have the power. And right now, whoever did it, has the power of that energy that's being sought for them, by the world. And I don't understand. I don't know why anybody would want that kind of exposure or want that kind of fame, Fame said, wow, I don't know. That I never wanted fame like that, that's for sure. It's nice to be known. It's nice to have an audience. It's nice to, but it's got, to come at a price of your sanity. Well, that's something quite different, And I'm not about to go out there and be any much crazier than I already am. I mean, I say a lot of things. I put a lot of stuff on the line, but my readership increases every day. And I see, just remarkable numbers, and from all over the world. And I ran into a good friend of mine. He's a journalist, writer, and he actually built my first website back in 2003. And he and I had some issues. That was during the
That was a weird time. We were still friends, and I ran into him recently in a store, and I barely recognized him. And we got to talking, and we knew each other for so long, and asked him how he was doing, and how it seems funny how our lives all came into a circle, but he's doing something he never thought he'd be doing, and writing for a paper that he never thought he would, and my work is starting to go, it's an international audience now, so of, you know, it's 100,000, well, more than 100,000. I've had probably a million views, you know, in the last 10 years, or I should say 10, let's say 2004. Yeah, I've had over a million visitors. But right now I'm up to, I'm doing about, probably 10,000 a week, you know. That's pretty damn good, you know, for a website. I guess it's only because, like this friend of mine said, he says, Leo, you write truth. Well, I try to, you know, I try to be truthful with everything I write out there, and I try to be, try to say what I mean. But right now, I try to be as explicit as I can. And I play games. I play a lot of word games and stuff like that. But they're pretty obvious, you know. And they work. I feel that they work with the article that I'm writing. And sometimes it lightens up the mood or the tone of the, you know, the article. But the other word that Solowinski felt needed clarification was self-interest. Self-interest, like power, wears the black shroud of negativism and suspicion. To many, the synonym for self-interest is selfishness. The word is associated with a repugnant conglomeration of vices such as narrowness, self-seeking, and self-centeredness, everything that is opposite to the virtues of altruism and selflessness. This common definition is contrary, of course, to our everyday experiences as well as to the observation of all great students of politics and life. The myth of altruism as a motivating factor in our behavior can arise and survive only in a society bundled in the sterile gauze of New England Puritanism and Protestant morality, and tied together with the ribbons of Madison Avenue public relations. And it is one of the classic American fairy tales. From the great teacher of Judeo-Christian morality and the philosophers, to the economists and to the wise observers of the politics of man, there has always been universal agreement on the part that self-interest plays in a prime moving force in man's behavior. The importance of self-interest has never been changed. It has been accepted as an inevitable fact of life. In the words of Christ, greater love has no man than this, than a man who laid down his life for his friends. That was great. Aristotle said, in politics, everyone thinks chiefly of his own, hardly ever of the public interest. And Adam Smith said in The Wealth of Nations, noted that it is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard of their own interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their advantage. In all the reasoning found in the Federalist Papers,
no point is so general or so central and agreed upon as rich and poor alike are prone to act upon impulse rather than pure reason and to narrow conceptions of self-interest. Boy, is that the truth or not? To question the force of self-interest that pervades all areas of political life is to refuse to see man as he is, to see him only as we would like him to be. And yet, next to the acceptance of self-interest, there are certain observations I would like to make. Machiavelli, whom the idea of self-interest seems to have gained its greatest notoriety, at least among those who are unaware of the tradition, said, "This is the asserted in general of men, that they are ungrateful, fickle, fake, cowardly, covetous. As long as you succeed, they are yours entirely, and they will offer you their blood, their property, their life, and children when the need is far distant. But when it approaches, they turn against you." That is the truth, ain't it, folks? That's so true. That's what people do. I mean, you know, if there's no chance of you having to fight anybody, they'll say, "I'm all for you." All right? But, if you have to be the fighter, right, and they have to stand up for you, Machiavelli makes a moral mistake when he rules out the moral factors of politics and holds purely to the self-interest as he defines it. The mistake can only be accounted for on the basis that Machiavelli's experience as an active politician was not too great, for otherwise he could not have overlooked the obvious fluidity of every man's self-interest. The overall case must be of a larger dimensions than that of self-interest. Narrowly defined, it must be large enough to include and provide for the shifting dimensions of self-interest. You may appeal to one self-interest to get me to the battle boat to fight, but once I am there, my prime self-interest becomes to stay alive, and if we are victorious, my self-interest may, and usually does, dictate entirely unexpected goals rather than those I had before the war. For example, the United States in World War II fervently allied with Russia against Germany, Japan, and Italy, and shortly after victory, fervently allied with its former enemies, Germany, Japan, and Italy, against its former ally, the USSR. These drastic shifts of self-interest can be rationalized only under a huge, limitless umbrella of general moral principles, such as liberty, justice, freedom, a law higher than man-made law, and so on. Okay? And morality, so-called, becomes the continuum as self-interest shifts. It says, within this morality, there appears to be a tearing, or rather a tearing conflict between tearing conflict, probably due to the layers of inhibitions in our kind of moralistic civilization. It appears shameful to admit that we operate on the basis of naked self-interest, so we desperately try to reconcile every shift of circumstance that is to our self-interest in terms of a broad moral justification, our rationalization. With one breath, we point out that we are utterly opposed to communism, but that we love the Russian people. loving people is in keeping with the tenets of our civilization. What we hate is the atheism and the suppression of the individual that we attribute as characteristics substantiating the immorality of communism. On this, we base our powerful opposition. We do not admit the actual fact, our own self-interest. We proclaim all of these negative, diabolical Russian characteristics just prior to the Nazi invasion of Russia. And the Soviets were with the cynical despots who connived in the long aggression pact with Hitler, the ruthless invaders who brought disaster to the Poles and to the Finns. And they were a people in chains and in misery, held in slavery by a dictator's might. They were a people whose rulers so distrusted them that the Red Army was not permitted to have live ammunition because they might turn their guns against the Kremlin. All this was our image, but within minutes of the invasion of Russia by the Nazis, when self-interest dictated the defeat of Russia would be so disastrous to our interests, then suddenly they became the gallant, great, warm, loving Russian people. The dictator became the benevolent and loving Uncle Joe, and the Red Army soon was filled with trust and devotion to its government, fighting with an unparalleled bravery and employing a scorching earth policy against the enemy. And the Russians, the Russian allies, certainly had God on their side. After all, he was on ours, and our June 1941 shift was more dramatic and, whatever. Kind of lost my spot here. I'm sorry. So self-interest becomes, is what we do everything for, basically. We're survivors. We survive. So we survive by knowing our own interests, and protecting them as much as we can, right? Depending on what kind of business you're in. But, it's obvious what you're always looking to protect your own interests, That's part of our lives. It's part of being human. Now, if somebody's else's interest is infringing upon my interests, right, then you have a conflict, okay? And that happens. Happens very often. So, I guess from that we learn, And the last word, next word is compromise. Compromise is another word that carries shades of weakness, vacillation, betrayal of ideas, surrender of moral principles. In the old culture, when virginity was a virtue, one referred to a woman's being compromised, and the word is generally regarded as ethnically unsavory and ugly. But to the organizer, compromise is a key and beautiful word. It is always present in the pragmatics of operation. It is making the deal, getting the vital breather, using the victory. If you start with nothing, demand 100%, then compromise for 30%, and you're 30% ahead. So, compromise, folks. That's what you got to do. Got to find a compromise, or else you'll all go nuts. A free and open society is an ongoing conflict interrupted periodically by compromises, and which then become the start for continuation of conflict, compromise, and on ad infinitum. And control of power is based on compromise in our Congress and among the executive, legislative, judicial branches. A society devoid of compromise is totalitarian. But if I had to be to define a free and open society in one word, the word would be compromise. The next word that Alinsky disliked so much is the word ego. All definitions of words, like everything else, are relative. Definition is to a major degree dependent upon your partisan position. Your leader is always flexible. He has pride in the dignity of his cause, and he is unflinching, sincere, and ingenious, an ingenious tactician, fighting the fight, the good fight. For the opposition, he is unprincipled, although whichever way the wind blows, his arrogance is masked by a fake humility. He is dogmatically stubborn, a hypocrite, unscrupulous, and unethical, and he will do anything to win. He is leading the forces of evil. On one side, he is a demagogue, the other, a demigod. Therefore, or rather, nowhere is the relativity of a definition more germane in the arena of life than the word ego. Anyone who is working against the haves is always facing odds, and in many cases, heavy odds. If he or she does not have the complete self-confidence, or call it ego, that he can win, then the battle is lost before it's begun. I have seen so-called trained organizers go out to another city with an assignment of organizing a community of approximately 100,000 people. Take one look and promptly wire a resignation. To be able to look at a community of people and say to yourself, I will organize them in many weeks. I will take on the corporations, the press, and anything else, is to be a real organizer. Ego, as we understand and use it here, cannot be even vaguely confused with, nor is it remotely related to egotism. And no, ego moves on every level. How can an organizer respect the dignity of an individual if he does not respect his own dignity? And how can he believe in people if he does not really believe in himself? And how can he convince people that they have it within themselves, that they have the power to stand up to win, if he does not believe it of himself? So ego must be so all-pervading that the personality of the organizer is contagious, and it converts the people from despair to defiance, creating a mass ego. And I admire that, because that's really true. That's what we're all on. We want people to make people one voice, The conflict. Conflict is another bad word in the general opinion. This is a consequence of two influences in our society. One influence is organized religion. The other is espoused a rhetoric of turning the other cheek, and has quoted the scriptures of the devil never would have dared because of their major previous function of supporting the establishment. The second influence is probably the most subversive and insidious one, and it has permeated the American scene in the last generation. That is Madison Avenue's public relations, middle-class moral hygiene, which has made of a conflict of controversy something negative and undesirable. This is all part of the advertising culture that emphasizes getting along with people and avoiding friction. If you look at our television commercials, you will get the picture that American society is largely devoted to ensuring that no orders come from our mouths or armpits. And consensus is a keynote. One must not offend one's fellow man. And so today we find that people in the mass media are fired for expressing their opinions or being controversial. And in the churches, they are fired for the same reason. The way this P is, yeah. Consensus is keynote. One must not offend one's fellow men. And today we find that people in the mass media are fired, right? So, and in the churches, we are fired. They are fired for the same reason, but the words used there are lacking in prudence. And on university campuses, faculty members are fired for the same reasons, but the words used there are personality difficulties. Conflict is the essential core of free and open society. If one were to project the democratic way of life in the form of a musical score, the major theme would be the harmony of dissonance. And on that note, I'll leave you with those thoughts from a great man, Saul Alinsky, Rules for Radicals. Check that out. I want to thank everybody who joined me this week. And sorry I missed last night. I hope... All goes well. So good night, everybody.